far away from my friend and relation, betrayed by the black velvet band.
Hello and welcome to the Shropshire Witches podcast. I'm Amy.
And I'm Alex.
And today we are carrying on with our exploration of the history of makeup and beauty standards and all that lovely stuff. Now, just to recap for those who maybe haven't listened to it for a while or haven't listened to the first episode. The first episode, we looked at medieval beauty standards. We looked how a medieval woman should really look an awful lot like a spoon. And then we moved on to look at things from the early modern and the Georgian period with a particular focus on mouse hair and merkins. So I think we should jump straight in, and I think we should actually move into the Victorian period and look at some Victorian beauty standards and some Victorian ideas of what it means to be beautiful. And I know exactly the person for that job. That is our resident Victorian, who was born in 1802, I believe.
I was, yeah.
Alex.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I am Victorian obsessed, as Amy knows. So this is very much the era that I get, I think, probably the most excited about. So talking about Victorian beauty, which is something, again, that I am just fascinated by, I think, because obviously harking back to kind of the musical episode a while ago now, the two things are kind of very entwined, I think. And Victorian beauty, and let's... We say Victorian, so I know sort of 1837 to 1901, but we're going to go a little bit before and probably going into the Edwardian era as well. So we're going to use it as a fairly general term, but there might be some things that are slightly out of the specific dates for anyone being pedantic. But it just sounds nicer than saying the 19th century. So let's kind of say, we'll say the Victorian period. So the Victorians were fantastic at the art of poisoning, basically. So we'll save this for another episode, Amy. We go into
curing
and things like that. But what I find fascinating about the Victorians is this sort of stark contrast. So first of all, makeup was taboo, which, as we discussed last week, is nothing new. The idea of being seen sort of wearing makeup was frowned upon because basically it was reserved for actresses and prostitutes, which they also thought the two jobs were interchangeable as well. So the there you go. So the idea of wearing makeup or kind of painting your face for decorative purposes was really, really frowned upon. But on the other hand, was also seen as an essential part of daily life. But you had that very fine line between looking effortlessly beautiful and looking slutty, as a 19th century man might perceive you. So obvious makeup, complete taboo. What I also love actually about the Victorians, because we think of these sort of very famous paintings and photographs and things like that. But of course, a lot of those were touched up as well, which I think is funny. So they kind of had the Photoshop of their day. They loved a filter. Those guys were all into it. So this idea of the angel in the house, the woman sort of coming over from the early Victorian period and going into Queen Victoria's sort of marital bliss, in inverted commas, any Victorian fans will know that it was slightly more complicated than that. And her sort of borderline obsession with her husband, who was also a bit controlling. Anyway, we can go into that another time. But she sort of painted this idea, and it's key to remember this when it comes to beauty. She painted this idea, especially a younger Victoria, of a woman famed for her fecundity, because she had 9 children, but also famed for her domesticity. And she set the precedence, really, for how women should be seen, which was fertile and sort of self-composed and dignified, which is all smoke and mirrors, we know. But this was the idea. So they wanted clear faces, bright eyes, tinted lips, but everything had to look natural. That's key. Eyebrows were lightly plucked, and they could be darkened, and with things like soot.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because I was getting soot and ash confused.
Darken them with fag ash.
I know, I always do this with Swedes and turnips as well. I know the difference, but sometimes I'm like, guys, when you're side by side, it's tough.
What's the difference?
Yeah, I know. They're all root vegetables, aren't they? Maybe I've got that wrong as well. It's like the High Sleek all over again. But they've got, honestly, when I was doing the editing in the High Sleek bit, I was like, do I cut? I was like, can't cut that. Like, because
no,
they need to know that, obviously.
We don't know what a house leak is.
They need to know that I'm...
After that, just as a brief aside, my partner, Callum, heard the episode and he went, you do know what a house leak is, Amy, because you have one in the house and it is a succulent. So apparently we have house leaks, they're succulent. So that's a little error on our part.
I feel like I can imagine him saying that as well. It's the fact that I was like, are they in the leak family? Like, I think so.
Probably, yeah.
I googled those. Oh, I don't think they are. I didn't know what one was. So you were still a step ahead of me. But yeah, and you've got
one. I didn't know I had one.
So Monty Don over there. So going back to the eyebrows were lightly plucked and darkened with natural ingredients. Eyeliner vanished in the Victorian era. So we did discuss this, and I know you'll go more into this with your area, and you love the eyeliner, and I do too. But the medieval look probably looked quite unfinished to us as well, and the Victorians absolutely so. So they were kind of, they loved perfume, things like that, floral scents. That was very much a vibe. That's, you know, it was giving that kind of era. But they rouged things like this, and they had lots of different recipes for that. And of course, then you had things like Yardley's Lavender was a big name. And then later on again, you had Pond's Cream. But they came in these beautiful glass bottles, little tins, little jars, things like this. It was all very beautiful until you sort of went into the realms of deadly makeup. So I love this. So deadly makeup, women would go just as we do today. And I'm going to say women just for the conventions of the Victorian sort of approach to beauty. So women would go to great lengths to appeal to appear in the natural look, which we still do, don't we? Because there's makeup tutorials all over YouTube that says natural makeup.
Yeah, clean girl makeup.
Clean girl, that's it, exactly.
What's that?
All this stuff. You're like, what's that? But the thing is about this is it was often deadly. So lead-based, it's back. The lead is back. No Thomas Aquinas, but the lead's back. it was popular in Georgian times, and the Victorians were like, yeah, let's get a piece of that pie. I did mention last week as well that they would have, get ready, arsenic wafers to brighten the eyes and end your life. And they believed it gave you a translucent complexion, which I've no doubt at one point it probably did.
Yes.
I think bad things were coming on swift wings not long after that translucent complexion. They would use, as I mentioned again last week, belladonna in the eyes because this would dilate the pupils. This, I don't know why this fact always gives me life because I'm like, the pursuit of beauty, absolutely, I get it. And the pursuit of youth and all these things. Belladonna in your eyes, I think, unless that's doing something that really is like, God, that looks good, doesn't it? Is it worth going blind for?
No.
Exactly. A cheaper alternative, so the thrifty amongst us, could use lemon juice or orange juice. So squirt that in your eyes, girls, and see what you could do. The other thing about all this sort of makeup was that it was clandestine. So the idea was that it was all sort of done on the down low, basically. You sort of wanted to be kind of hidden. And also another fact that I find fascinating, and this is particularly wealthy female clients, they would have their makeup hidden in old prescription bottles.
Oh, wow, I like that.
It's fascinating. So whereas today, and perhaps not so long before today, there was kind of, you know, you're sort of quite aware or quite, prescriptions are kind of quite a private thing, aren't they? The Victorians are like, in contrast to that, I'm hiding my rouge in my, I don't know, my pessary or my thrush cream or whatever it may be. Something for your, I don't know, for your calluses and things. But they obviously find that infinitely less embarrassing than the wearing makeup. So there you go. But they were all called beautiful things like Harriet's, Hubbard's cleanser and things like this. These cold creams, they were fantastic. So then it kind of, it'll move more into the Edwardian era. But I think what I want to do is, that's going into your era, and I think we can back and forth with this, but the reason I'm kind of not like passing over it quickly, but is because I want to tell you a story, because to me, nothing encompasses the Victorian beauty ideal quite like Sarah Leveson. Is the name that most people probably know her by, but in fact she's most famous for being known as Madame Rachel. Now, she was born, grew up somewhere near Drury Lane when it's less than salubrious as it is today. And Madame Rachel was quite an industrious woman, and she at one point worked in what would have been sort of the Victorian fast food. So basically,
All right.
Victorian fast food would have been hot potatoes, fried fish, things like this. And she was quite industrious, and she was doing quite well. She also, where she was living, she worked as selling secondhand clothes, basically. So a wardrobe dealer, they would have been known as, but obviously not dealing in wardrobes, dealing in secondhand clothes. And she would, obviously, within those realms and where she was, be selling and buying dresses from actresses. She also had involvements in people in sex work and worked for a man that was a this is a some of this is hazy because they think, did it come out when she went to trial, but it seems pretty likely that it was true, and as the story goes on, you'll think it probably was true. But Rachel worked as a procuress, I can never say it very well, but basically almost like a sort of a female pimp in essence. She brings it, so women basically was what she was procuring. But she basically went on, she claimed, this is the story that she claimed, she didn't claim this bit, but she claimed the bit that I'm about to say. She was taken ill, and I can't remember what she had, but she had something that sort of weakened her and basically left her ill for her adulthood, really. So she was, if you see a photo of her, she's not what you call a babe. Now, I know it's all about character and things like that, but she was, yeah, she was certainly, she looked a bit like an old boot. Like she was not like, she was not a, yeah, she looked like she'd been around the block. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, it's Google her. It's so worth it. It's so worth it. She looks like a character, which I kind of find fascinating as well, given that she goes on to sell cosmetics. But anyway, basically, she, this illness, she said, despite not being beautiful, she'd always had this amazing thick black hair. And this illness had sadly made her hair thin and started to fall out. That's if this is true. And she claimed that she spoke to the doctor and said, is there anything I can do, a tonic or something? And they love tonics, the Victorians, didn't they, for my hair? To which he gave her a recipe, which she keeps secret, of course. And miraculously, this beautiful hair grew back. So she thought, right, I'm going to go into the beauty industry. Now, she would have been the equivalent of like sort of marketing slogan genius and things like that. Like she really knew how to market herself. And she started to do well. And in the end, she got property on Bond Street in the Mayfair district. And that's where she was a cosmetician. So in 1863, she was calling herself Madame Rachel. And she was looking for wealthy customers. So she even claimed to be sort of procuring things for the Queen, which the Queen Victoria obviously was not true. But she also played into this sort of Victorian ideal, which people loved things from the Middle East. So she was claiming things were from Jordan and things like this. You know, they were called things like magnetic rock dew of the Sahara, things like that, like removed your wrinkles. To be honest, what's that cream now that everyone spends a fortune? Oh, La Mer, whatever it is. Like hundreds of jar, and you're like, just use Nivea creme and shut up. You know, it's the same thing. And Royal Arabian face creams, and honey of Mount Hymettus and things like all these things. She just came up with great names. Initially, she'd been hawking bottles in Wapping, which I think is great. And she just kind of moved up and up, and she was doing really, really well. Now, I won't go through the whole story because there's so much detail. It would be a whole episode on Rachel, which would be hilarious. But yeah, she was selling these things at what would have been the equivalent of sort of £90 a throw in today's money. And
wow.
Yeah, oh yeah, some go more and more. Some go up to like £1,500. And that's, yeah, it's insane. That's for enamelling, which I will tell you briefly about, because Madame Rachel lifted quite a few ideas, but she also claimed to have come up with the idea of enamelling ladies' faces, which had been around. But do you know what's interesting? It's Queen Victoria's daughter, Alexandra, daughter-in-law, sorry, Princess of Wales. She was her daughter-in-law. She was famous for this sort of slightly enameled, strange look. And basically, it would almost like freeze your face, which I think we've seen people like today. But it was like a coating that would go on your face. And the thing is, if you laughed or did anything, it would sort of like crease and crack, a bit like when people say put like egg whites on your face. But then when you move, it's like. So anyway, she did this enamelling, and it was supposed to make you look completely flawless. It was 20 guineas, which is £1,500, give or take. And it was a simple method. I know, it's insane. So basically, they would shave the face of any fuzz and things like this, and then she would apply these lotions in a copious amount of alkaline toilet washes. And basically, it would fill in your wrinkles or any depressions or anything in the face that are perfectly natural with this sort of thick white paste. And then she'd dust you with rouge and a powder to finish off. It must have looked mental, is what I'll say to her. But she made a fortune off this. And the reason it was, it got, and I'll sort of skip through this now because otherwise it's a long story, but because she was appealing to wealthy women were starting to, you know, marketing was in its early days in terms of how we think of it, but she was starting, people were starting to want to spend their money on things like cosmetics. So, the plot thickens. So she would do this, but they didn't want to tell their husbands what they were spending money on. And she was costing them a fortune. So they'd put it on the tick. And then she'd say, well, you've got to settle your tab. And they'd be fucked, basically, because there'd be huge bills that they couldn't pay. And then they'd have to give her things like jewellery as a down payment.
That's amazing.
Yeah, honestly, this woman, she's a lat. She's giving extra, I can tell you. And hasn't... this poor woman, this is really sad, actually, so I shouldn't laugh. But this one woman came forward. And had to tell her family what had happened because she'd just got no way of paying Rachel. So things started to spiral. But she told this woman that a man had seen her at Madame Rachel. She got her children involved. She dressed her son up as like a sort of in a kind of traditional Middle Eastern costume. Her daughters were kind of walking around looking like they're in a sort of a harem. You know, she made a whole thing and there was incense. It was a vibe. But she told this young woman that an earl, or I can't remember what his title was, had been near in the vicinity. And had seen her and thought she was beautiful and was interested in marrying her. But she was saying, well, if you want to marry someone like that, you have to be beautiful. So she'd sold more of her products to her. It was all cock and balls, by the way. It was just completely made up. But what it did come out in trial is that Rachel was also letting gentlemen watch these women in their Turkish baths through a Judas hole in the wall. So she was also letting men pay to watch her customers bathe and things like that. So Rachel was, let's just say, industrious, shall we? She knew how to make money. I think that's quite a lot to have a Judas hole in the wall for men to peep through at your customers bathing, unbeknownst to them. I would say Rachel's a bit naughty. A lot of what she does is naughty. Anyway, she went to trial. She was found guilty. She did go to prison, but she was taken ill when she was in prison. And so she went out to convalesce into a hospital that was basically at that point they termed it as for invalid inmates. Okay, so not my wording, obviously. But anyway, eventually she was let out of her 5-year sentence on good behaviour. Okay, so it wasn't long before Rachel was back at it. And she was using ingredients like arsenic, corrosive supplements, prussic acid, lead carbonate, all these fun ingredients. Okay. Rachel was, she was mixing it up. Anyway, Mary Borrowdale, by the way, was this young girl. And so she was ridiculed in the paper alongside Rachel. Rachel was vilified, but Mary was kind of really sort of bullied and made fun of, which I think is really, really sad. 6 years after she got out, so 1872, she was up to it again. And in 1878, she was once again sent to jail, where sadly she did die. She did die.
Yeah.
She did die in prison. But she died in Woking Prison, and she died in 1880, 2 years into her sentence. Some of the things, she's buried in... a Jewish cemetery in London, but she was Jewish. And in the paper, they were quite anti-Semitic. They did make some very cruel barbed jokes on that front, which I think is hideous, but she do some pretty bad things. She's a complicated character. Somehow, you can't help but be fascinated by her. Her daughter was quite a well-known operatic soprano who did survive the scandal. Yeah, which is amazing. And she sung at Covent Garden and various places. But she was a fascinating woman. And I think she, to me, epitomises the idea of the Victorian beauty, but also the corruption behind it. I think she's fascinating. I think she's a bit of a madam, quite literally. But I did think, it's a story I heard, God, like years ago, and I picked it up again recently. And when we decided to do this, I thought there is one person I've been dying to mention to you. And I was like, Amy is going to be loving a bit of Madame Rachel.
Queen, absolute queen.
I know.
The sexual exploitation, not at all.
And the Judas hole.
But I think it's that idea that is so pertinent within the Victorian period of people who know how to play the system.
Yeah.
And they know, they drag themselves up by their bootstraps, and you get these wonderful stories. And I think she's possibly one of the best I've heard, of just absolute corruption, but also, you know, you've got to admire that tenacity, I suppose, yeah, to get to where she was. And I like the fact that she was absolutely unredeemable as well. I'm going back to prison. Oh, I'll do that. Yeah, I'm in good behaviour and I'll carry on doing what I was doing. My customers need me.
Very quickly as well. And I thought, just quickly, by past, I wanted to just read a couple of her adverts, because I just thought she'd be a CEO or something now. But like, and honestly, there's some, you know, people in very high positions who are way more corrupt than Madame Rachel. But
oh yeah,
she was everything that the Victorian society wanted to kind of bash. And they wanted to humiliate these high society women as well. But Beautiful Forever, that was her famous thing. So Beautiful Forever, A Book of Beauty, Madame Rachel on Female Grace and Beauty, just published, price 2 shillings 6 pence to be... to be had of Madame Rachel, 147A New Bond Street. Youth, and the last one, Youth and Beauty, the Peach Blossom Cream and Alabaster Powder, the Magnetic Rock Dew Water from Sahara, Arabian Soaps and Alabaster Liquid. These costly and inimitable toilet preparations render the hair, teeth and complexion beautiful beyond comparison. Can be had only at Madame Rachel's, 47A New Bond Street, which she can be consulted daily. All communications are strictly confidential.
Oh, I love that.
Might as well. Yeah. So there you go, yeah. Madame Rachel. She was a lot.
Yeah. I think that's the best way of describing her, isn't it? Is that she was a lot.
Yeah. She'd have been more verbose than us. And like, if we said, yeah, Rachel's a lot, she'd be like, look at those adverts I wrote and you're calling me a lot.
But yeah. Like,
you are a lot.
Yeah. You are a lot. That was a lot. That was, I do love, and it's something I'll echo when I, in a little bit, when the kind of obsession with the Middle East that comes from this period, and I suppose you could call it Egyptomania, in like, yeah, when you get into the 20s, and that idea of that exoticism to the point of almost fetishization being really in the cultural narratives and the idea of what is beautiful in this period. And I think that's something that you see echoed from the Victorian time going way into like the 20s, really. That's the height of particularly with Egypt, of it. And it is, it's how something that is other can be so appealing. And because it's other and because it's exotic, it must mean that you are beautiful. And I do think it must have been interesting to sit in the marketing meetings, right? Where's this cream going to be from? Yeah. We'll have it from the Sahara. The Sahara is known for being the place of creams. You know, it's,
you can't say Margate, can you? Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's, do they pick the place based on something, or is it like, oh, that'll do, that one? Sahara sounds exotic, we'll have that.
Like that. Yeah. That's,
yeah.
I think that's exactly it. I think that's, it's fascinating, isn't it? And I think even today, and obviously, you know, people are more aware of, quite rightly, of cultural appropriation, things like that, but there's still things, you know, like any kind of shampoos. French skincare is having such a vibe, isn't it? Like French pharmacy skincare. So all these kind of French names that over in the UK and other places, you know, we're like, oh, it's got a French name, so that's it. You know, and they do it in fashion and whatever else, and Korean skincare, of course, as well.
Yeah, Korean, yeah.
Is a big thing, isn't it? So, and they do the same, as we discussed very briefly last week with perfumes and things, these names. The second you give something, you're absolutely on the nose, a sort of an exotic, in inverted commas, name, that's it. People are, they're all over it, aren't they? And some things they want to be sort of reassuringly kind of blighty, like your Pond's cold cream and all that sort of stuff. But they were starting to think, well, that was kind of like people do today. I mean, I think Pond's is having a moment because it's great, but so it's on TikTok and stuff. God, I've never sounded so old. It's on TikTok.
On the TikTok.
On the TikTok, where the children go. yeah, it's interesting to see these old things that kind of like come forward with their kind of like stoic names. Sometimes people kind of have it's like a flush of nostalgia, but ultimately the things that people kind of want on their dresser or the things on show always have a slightly more beautiful name. Like Jo Malone was always calling it things like, what was it, English Oak and whatever.
Yeah.
Like, and it was a load of bollocks. Like, it'd be a nice perfume, but it didn't, I mean, what the chuff does an oak tree smell like anyway? Like, oh, no, this smells like an oak tree. And the oak tree's going, well, I don't, I'm odorless largely. So,
yeah. Yeah, let's go outside and sniff one and see if it's.
Exactly.
You know, like, when, do you know, like, to be on the subject of the kids, you know, when the kids go and touch grass, maybe we should go and sniff that oak tree.
Go and sniff an oak tree. Okay, see what you get. Go and smoke a laburnum tree. Smoke? I can't even go and sniff a laburnum tree. You can sniff a laburnum. It won't do this if you eat it, isn't it?
Yeah.
That it kills you. But so there you go. That took a dark turn. But yeah, Jo Malone with a, I don't know what she's doing now.
No, I don't.
Pretty somewhere with all her money. But Penhaligon's do it as well. And Penhaligon's love a bit of a kind of Egyptian or kind of Arabian sort of names, things like that. They Penhaligon's are well into that, aren't they? And then by contrast, they have like Blenheim Bouquet, which actually smells really, really good. I love Blenheim Bouquet. But they do kind of things that they feel are sort of reassuringly traditional and other things that have an air of the exotic about it. And we're like, oh, exciting. But we still do it in the way the Victorians did as well. We just don't put belladonna in our eyes.
At the moment.
I can tell you, people thought it would work. They definitely would. Like there's
oh, yeah.
People do, like, do you remember years ago that Kylie lip challenge thing? And people were like putting their lips in a glass and stuff to get them arranged. People will look back at the stuff we do and be like, God, like we might not be eating arsenic wafers, but we're still doing quite bizarre stuff.
Silly things,
beauty. Especially certain cosmetic surgeries and things that we don't know the long-term effects of, but they're like, hey, let's just see, shall we? And you're like, well, I have a feeling you're going to age like milk if you carry on doing that. But yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, who am I to judge my big jumper with my top knot? So yeah.
Same. Are we matching? Oh my God.
We're always matching. I was like, oh, should I get spruced up for the podcast? I said, nah, fuck it.
No, cozy socks.
Yeah, I have. I've got those fleecy socks on, which are like the same. You give like somebody who's about to have a long stay in a hospital.
Yes, grippy socks. Yeah, same.
Sometimes they like, I've got like old wooden floors. So I was like, oh, hey, up.
You might have a fall.
I may stumble, but sometimes I wear them to bed and I think cozy. And then I wake up in the middle of the night, like, right, it's hotter than the sun. And you're like, those bloody socks. So I sort of fumble down and throw them, you know, I throw them with wild abandon. I throw them across the room. but, you know, talking of having a fall, very quick story before you go to reliance on the Edwardians. But there, a couple of years ago now, I went to the pub for a drink with a friend. Like, I don't tend to go wild, as you know. Despite the sock story, guys, I don't go wild. And I was only out for a couple of hours and the dogs were at home and they were fine. Tommy and Serge, little terriers. Amy knows them, they're great. And Amy knows that Tommy is dramatic. It was a summer's evening, so the French doors were open so they could get outside. Yeah, they were fine. Anyway, I left my phone at home on charge, didn't need it, blah, blah, blah. Got home a couple of hours later, literally a couple of hours, pub just down the road. And my then neighbour, she's moved now, not because of this, because she was elderly and it's too remote up here. But she texts me a couple of times. She goes, I'm just making sure you're okay because Tommy was barking at one point. She goes, and I was worried you'd had a fall. And I was thinking, which was very sweet of her because she was old as well. But I was thinking, I'm not 90. I was like, oh, it's all fine. I won't say her name. But I was like, it's all fine. Don't worry. I just nipped it. So Tommy was just probably barking at some birds outside. But I was like, Tommy barking is not conducive with me having fallen down the stairs.
She's died.
Also, can I say, if I did fall, Tommy cares so little for my welfare that he would not raise the alarm. He would just be like, it wouldn't feature. He's more interested in the crow or something that's in the garden. He is not worried about me as a mass at the bottom of the stairs. Like that would.
I love that.
Yeah. So it's good of her to be concerned, but it was misplaced concern. Tommy wouldn't give a shit. Right, go on.
He's got his demons. He's got his vices.
I was going to say he's got his strengths, but you know, he's looking at me now from the chaise longue, just looking. He's got something stuck on his. Yeah, I can see you. He's, you know, when they do that thing where they look like they've got something in their mouth, and you're like, oh, that's that.
Yeah, that's something that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, you're like, oh, don't know what you've eaten, don't know what you found. Anyway, something from outside. Right, go on then. What have you got for us, Amy?
So I'd like to carry on by kind of staying in the Victorian period briefly before moving on to looking at Edwardians and that kind of era, which I'm obsessed with, because I want to look at the folklore of beauty within Shropshire.
Oh yeah, go on.
So this is by no means exhaustive. This is just some of the things that I think give a particularly Shropshire insight into beauty and some of the things that we have recorded from the Victorian period. So it's quite interesting because the beauty kind of that we have written down are very much your tips from your more working class, your more rural agrarian classes.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is very, very linked to the natural world. So there's almost the idea that natural items, and that's not to say they weren't slapping arsenic on their faces as well, because they probably were. They're probably doing that too.
Sorry, carry on.
But there's the idea that something that is naturally beautiful in the natural world is going to enhance or beautify you within your own self.
Yeah.
So we have numerous references of like different flowers that girls might wear. Like we mentioned dog rose last episode. But overwhelmingly in Shropshire, beauty was very much linked to the moon and the phases of the moon, which I think is really interesting because the moon has such a long-standing association with femininity and the phases of a woman's cycle, just like the phases of the moon. But in particular, if you wanted to grow your hair and you wanted your hair to grow long and luxurious and shiny, you had to make sure that you only cut it during the waxing of the moon.
Okay.
Because if you trimmed your hair during a waxing moon, it would strengthen it and it would grow beautifully and it would enhance your overall desirability. However, if you cut it during a waning moon, it would make you a bit ugly. It was meant to not only make your hair grow dull and lifeless, it was meant to make you overall just a bit bleh.
Yeah.
So it doesn't just end there, though, because we have a number of references to moon water. So for pagans who might be listening, we might have some pagans.
I hope so.
Moon water, I hope so too. Moon water obviously has a lot of potency within spells and spell work. And it's the idea that if you charge water by the light of the moon, it can have its own special power. In Shropshire, that was the case. But also, if you knew that it was going to rain in the evening, what you would do is you'd put out your old jam jars and you'd collect the rainwater that would then be charged by the light of the moon.
Oh, wow.
And that rainwater was said to be the best thing that you could do, you could use to wash your hair and your face. It was meant to enhance your glow. And we've touched on this quite a bit. There's a kind of overarching idea with many of these centuries that the idea of a very pale face was desirable, which is, you know, completely nonsense. Some of the most beautiful people I've seen in the world have been people with all different complexions, but yeah, within the Victorian context, the paler you were, the more kind of innocence and all that kind of thing. So moon water was said to be able to have the ability to make you fairer, make you paler, but also strengthen and make your hair very desirable. And this is one that I knew of for quite a long time because my grandmother used to do it. So when she was a lot younger, she grew up in around the Bridge North area, in quite a rural kind of farm labourers kind of world. And she swore by this. She had very dark hair, much like mine. She would collect rainwater and she'd wash her hair with rainwater. And she swore that it made her hair grow beautifully. And interestingly as well, rainwater can be used for all sorts of things in Shropshire as long as it's been collected by moonlight. So rain that's fallen on Ascension Day is said to, if you collect it by the light of the moon, it's said to be able to cure diarrhea and stomach complaints.
Okay.
So, you know, maybe if you kill two birds with one stone and you collect your hair washing water and your diarrhea water.
Say, if you got the shit, you're going outside collecting water by moonlight.
Yeah.
Too far from the outdoor lavatory, but, you know, or
sort it out. Yeah. Perfect.
Shit yourself. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're and it is. So it doesn't matter.
No. And it is. It certainly has a lot of prevalence in Shropshire, but it's known to beautify. And interestingly as well, we're told that, by Charlotte Byrne, that on May Day and on Midsummer's Day, but that's only around the villages around the Wrekin, that you had to get up extra early and wash your face with the dew from the grass and the surrounding areas. And that would make you more beautiful. It would make you more desirable and it would clear your complexion up. So if you had any skin complaints, and also it was good for bathing your joints. So if you had aching joints and you wanted to be more beautiful, you collected the May dew and washed yourself with it. And then you'd spend the day collecting flowers, dancing in the woods and the maypole, which, to be honest, sounds like my perfect day.
Say, yeah, great.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah.
Yeah,
I'll be there.
sounds like a plan.
See you there, babe. Yeah.
And one of the other things I want to just briefly mention before we move away from folklore is a really kind of bizarre snippet that I found, and I've only ever found reference to it once in Shropshire folklore, and it was written in the early 1800s. And it was the idea that Shropshire women were known to be very dark-haired and beautiful.
Yeah.
But in particularly what made them so desirable was their very thick, dark, black eyebrows.
Okay.
Obviously, that escaped me because mine are barely there.
Got dark hair, but got dark eyebrows. Not so thick, but that's fine.
Not so thick.
That's so thick.
And And apparently it was like, it was a widely known beauty standard at the time. And I don't know how widely known it actually was, because as I've said, I've only found one reference to it.
Widely known. It's quite widely, widely mentioned once, very well.
But it was said that men found women from Shropshire so beautiful because of their thick, hairy eyebrows. So maybe I'm doing something wrong. But
me too. Me.
Apparently, like, it became so popular that you would have women from outside of Shropshire trying to do a Shropshire, it was called, and grow their eyebrows and darken them, which I suppose links to what you said about how you could darken your eyebrows with like soot and things.
Yeah.
And apparently we just naturally had big bushy black brows, which again, never had, lost it. But
I love it. I was going to say, we're both very Shropshire as well. Like, I feel like
pretty
much so. And I'm like, oh, and apparently like before us, everyone was like Brooke Shields. And you're like, what?
Yeah, could that no
not
eyebrows
have stayed? I'm not going into the bikini line leg hair chat thing. No, that we could say that's a Shropshire beauty standard. If that's the case, I'm winning, mate. Like, you know, put the wax aside, babe. I'm back. But like her eyebrows, you're like, ah. Oh. I mean, mine are really dark, like yours, but I'm like, but they're not thick.
Yeah, all there really.
Like, yeah, all present. They're quite absent.
Yeah,
party. They've taken the day off. They're like, I'm not here. They're truant.
Yeah, truanting. Our eyebrows are truanting. But I think it's interesting because there's so much of the beauty standards we've seen moving through has been pale face, pale hair, hair like gold.
Yeah.
But from this, we're starting to move into that idea that dark hair can be desirable, and it does link to that kind of exoticism and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But certainly, if we're to move into the Edwardian period, if we fancy having a bit of a chat about that, there is that shift into darker hair being seen as a desirable kind of thing. So when I'm talking about the Edwardian era, just like yourself, I'm talking really from kind of the advent of the 1900s through to what we would now call the Edwardians, but it's very hard to differentiate in a fashion sense or a beauty standard sense, because what was acceptable and desirable in kind of 1905 was very similar in 1911, 1912, when we actually get into kind of the Edwardians. But certainly I've several references I've seen to kind of what the Edwardian beauty standard was a very clear, pale complexion, that was often achieved through layering kind of pale powder based makeup with pink rouge. Rouge was very big in this period, and also kind of more powder then applied onto it, so it gives you almost that effortless ghost with a bit of a red face kind of look.
I mean, that's my go-to.
Yeah, same.
I'm just going to guess it. Have you gone for ghost with a bit of a red face? I have, actually. Yeah, and you just thought I was blushing awkwardly.
It's ghost. Dream woman.
Yeah,
dream woman.
Okay, we need to hang out more. Ghost with a red face. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's like water that stops you shitting yourself. Yeah.
Actually, oh, no, I'm not. It's not Ascension Day yet.
Yeah, you're like, no, it's not, actually, Alex, okay? Google when Ascension Day is. Get your facts checked, yeah?
And so you've got this idea of paleness, you've got this idea of dark hair being very much a prominent feature when you first get into the Edwardian period. Mm-hmm. Rouge is acceptable. Lipstick still wasn't really. Again, you've got the same thing as the Victorians, the idea that if you are to wear makeup, it should be almost undetectable. interestingly, there is a bit of a connection, and we'll go on to lipstick in a little bit when I get to kind of like the 20s.
Yeah, cool.
That there's a link between the suffrage movement, women's suffrage, and lipstick, and some supporters of women's suffrage and suffragettes, they wore lipstick almost as a political statement to say, actually, you know, I'm here, I'm allowed to be me, I'm going to, you know, make a statement, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I do as well. Yeah.
So you can't really look at this whole, I suppose you could call it silent film era. So from the Edwardians through, without looking at silent film stars, the influence of the film industry that was blossoming at the time, and also how that affected beauty standards in general.
Yeah.
So it was still very much about the beautiful complexion at this stage. And there was still a lot of creams being used, very similar to, again, the Victorians. And really, it was from kind of World War One kind of period to slightly the aftermath of World War One that makeup began to be a bit more socially acceptable. And you really start to see this blossoming of the cosmetics industry. Max Factor is one of the big names of this period because it started off in film, but then they started selling a kind of like a flexible grease paint, which could be used, was mainly used for film, but also was used kind of in eyeshadow and not eyeshadow, that's something else he sold eyeshadow, but used for the more domestic market. And then he also started selling in 1916 eyeshadow and brow pencils. So he was really one of the kind of, and the company Max Factor was one of the first real makeup brands to hit that kind of turn of the century period. You've also got Maybelline,
iconic, yeah,
still to this day. They are actually credited with inventing the mascara as we, well, not as we know it, because it looked very different, but very similar to what we would now call mascara.
Away from that bit and polish one, like,
yes, it's,
so we can talk about it, but that's a cool, yeah, okay.
So he was, what was his name? Thomas Lyle Williams, he was called. And in 1915, he invented mascara, and it came in a very long kind of box, and it was usually used like Vaseline or spit to use it. But he supposedly named his company after his sister Mabel.
Okay.
And that was because Mabel used to coat her lashes with cork ash. She would burn like a cork from a bottle, and she would put a bit of Vaseline on and use it to coat her eyelashes to make them look bigger, which I think's brilliant and certainly ingenious.
Yeah.
While we're on the subject of eyelashes, one of my favorite bizarre kind of looks and beauty standards from this period is the eyelash beading.
Oh my God, tell us about this. Okay.
So it was originally a theatre technique, and it was used in kind of silent films. But we do have some rather brave women deciding to use it. And what it basically entailed was getting kind of, a Max Factor actually sold it, was a cosmetics wax, but you could use, if you were brave, candle wax. And you would apply it to your lashes. So kind of you'd brush it. I haven't really got many eyelashes, so I'd be knackered. But you brush it along your eyelashes, trying to get a little bead on the end of it. So you'd get kind of like a bead clumped at the end of each lash. And it gave you these very big spidery lashes that really opened the eyes, because big eyes became prominent, particularly with people like Clara Bow and a little bit later. But it was almost like you had these big spidery lashes with beads on the end of them to kind of open the eyes, and really rather bizarre and also quite dangerous putting wax in it near your eye.
Yeah.
But it certainly was, particularly when you get into that more of the influence of the silent film, it certainly was a beauty standard that was very kind of prized, and also something that was mirrored in quite a lot of films.
But think, I was just jumping in, because I just thought, think about your, excuse me, your Greta, your Greta Garbo. And also, of course, famously, absolutely from The Silence, which people forget is Joan Crawford. From The Silence to the talkies, they used to call them, didn't they? But both those had these kind of like, I suppose you'd call them come to bed eyes at one point, wouldn't you? Like these kind of sort of quite doe-eyed, this kind of look that, so yeah, absolutely. It was a thing, wasn't it? These kind of heavy, big sort of eyes that they really kind of made something of. It's fascinating. And of course, I suppose you've got to consider, same as you do on stage, that the sheer amount of makeup that you would have to wear, same as when the black and white films go into colour, it would completely change. But yeah, the colour of these lipsticks and mascaras and things must have looked really intense in person.
Yeah. And a lot of, not all silent films, but some, I think it's slightly later when you get into the 30s, when they're still black and white. In order to make red lipstick on kind of film, you had to almost wear like a green tinged one for it to look like it was red on the black and white.
Right, that's fascinating.
Yeah, so it was an art and film. We could do a whole discussion on special effects and film makeup in itself, but it was an absolute art to be able to do then, and as I imagine it is now. So really, I suppose you could split these two sections, this period, into two major kind of sections. You've got the throwback and kind of continuation of the Victorian beauty ideal, and then the rejection of it. So, and they can really be taken over and conveyed with two stereotypical girls. So the first one is the Gibson girl.
Oh yeah, classic. Go on.
Yeah, and
they're gorgeous, so by the way.
They are genuinely so stylish.
19th century figure. I know it's going into a different era, but they'd still got that sort of, you know, we can talk about corsets afterwards, but that curvaceous, yeah, the Gibson,
yeah,
beautiful big hair, everything gorgeous.
Yeah. So the Gibson girl was kind of invented, shall we say, by Charles Danner Gibson in 1890. Mm-hmm. And really, it was, like you said, still quite curvaceous figures. It was a bit more risque, but they were still certainly quite conservative when you compare them to the other one I'm about to speak about. And you had a very soft pompadour hairstyle that was all up. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to be particularly kind of, risque, you might have some curls or ringlets hanging down the side of your face. Very soft makeup, big eyes, rouge, pale skin. And it was modelled by kind of models and actresses like Camille Clifford and Evelyn Nesbit. Mm-hmm. And that was very much the beauty ideal from kind of the turn of the century through to certainly 1905, 1906, through to about the 1910s.
Yeah.
And it was, I suppose, depending on the Gibson girl was an American design. Charles Danner Gibson was American.
Okay.
And it was meant to epitomize what, you know, your American beauty was. But there was kind of an English version. It was, I suppose, in a way, it's that idea of like the English rose, very natural, doesn't try too hard, very feminine naturally. And if you had thin hair, for instance, so your hair wasn't big enough, what you would do is you'd take the hair from your hairbrush that kind of had fallen out after your hair had fallen, you'd brushed it, and you'd pad your hair out with the hair that had fallen off your head. And
Well, people do, because, you know, I know you and I both have sort of fairly thick hair, but they would make like a, I suppose like boots sell them, but you'd make, I think they were called a rat at one point, weren't they? Put them on and then put their hair round it. But yeah, I mean, that went on for quite a while, like into the 40s, didn't it? People doing it with
their
own hair, like pulling out of the hairbrush and then making a rat out of it.
Yeah. And that allowed you to have that illusion of thick hair, because thick hair is something throughout kind of, unless you're talking about the medieval where you had to look like a spoon.
Still today, though, everyone's obsessed with thick hair, aren't they? But
yeah, it's very much a beauty ideal that has stood the test of time. Kind of thick thick hair.
Kind of youth and health and things. It
seems
quite natural that people would find that, you know, like a sign. It's like a sign of health, isn't it? It's probably implanted in us to be like, oh, thick, like clear skin, you know, like if someone's complexion's good, you know, you kind of, there's obviously something in us that goes, oh, that must mean they're healthy. So if you look at the primeval mating thing, you're like, let's bang her because she's got thick hair and good skin. You're like, I know it's not as simple as that, but hey.
Yeah, let's give it a go.
Let's give that one a go based on just those two things. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, so you had the Gibson girl, and the Gibson girl was kind of the it girl of the first half of this period. Mm-hmm. The rejection of that really comes in two forms. It's the next stage, and then there's a little bit extra, which is probably the most synonymous with the Edwardian 20s. But the rejection, I think, of the Gibson girl was the vamp.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the vamp is interesting because it's our first real insight into the seductress, the siren, particularly on screen or on stage in this period. Now, the vamp was probably the absolute opposite of the Gibson girl, whereas the Gibson girl had the soft pompadour that was very ordered and clean. The vamp was often feral looking. I always think of that wonderful picture of Theda Bara with her big long hair, and she's holding it out and scowling. That to me is the archetypal vamp.
I'm just going to ask, because Theda Bara, gorgeous. So I said, oh yeah, before I even knew which picture you're referencing, because every picture of her is heaven.
Yes.
For me, there's kind of like the pinnacles are kind of the Victorian Edwardian beauty. Lily Elsie, for those that don't know, Google her. She was gorgeous, just dreamy, dreamy, dreamy. And she had the kind of the Gibson, the big eyes, that sort of, they would have sort of smaller mouths, but quite full lip, but like just very pretty. Everything was pretty, sort of pretty and very soft, wasn't it? Evelyn or Evelyn, depending on how you say, Evelyn Nesbitt, who I thought was gorgeous as well. She's a little bit more Theda, like kind of slightly more unusual looking. They're like my three kind of just pinnacles of absolute beauty. Do you prefer, I would say, and I love Theda, as you know this as well, I'm more inclined towards looking at the Gibson girls and going, oh, the beauty of that femininity, the big art, everything, I'm gorgeous. Are you more towards like the vamp or the Gibson girl? I'm interested which one you find more appealing.
I think the vamp appeals to me more because I've had a long-standing kind of relationship with goth fashion and being very into that subculture.
Yeah.
And I think Theda and the vamps walked so we could run.
That's cool.
Always think of like the Bauhaus movement, and there's a meme because I'm down with the kids, there's some Bauhaus students, and it says, I can't remember the meme because I'm paraphrasing, but they're all kind of very short haired and they've got the big eyeliner on, and they're androgynous, which we're going to look at androgyny in a minute.
Yeah.
And it kind of says that they look like they should be listening to the Bela Lugosi's Dead in the 80s kind of thing. So I do like the darkness. I like the kind of, it's not really the romanticism of the Victorian goth, but it certainly invokes Le Fanu and even things like Varney the Vampire and the vampire literature of the 1800s, the vamp. And really, I think it's the first time that women were actually trying to own their sexuality. I do think there is a flip side to it, where it becomes almost, and I mentioned this earlier, a fetishization of the exotic, without them being actually exotic. Theda Bara, her identity, and she was not necessarily involved in the creation of her persona. It was all the film industry that created it, but it's an anagram of Arab death. She was a Jewish girl from Cincinnati, but they made up a story of
she is.
Everything. Yeah.
Wow.
Everything about her personality was completely invented. And really, she's the first real instance of this happening where the film industry has spun an absolute yarn to make her seem more exotic. So she was given the fictitious persona of an Egyptian-born woman who was interested in the occult.
Yeah.
she wasn't, as I said, she was from Cincinnati and she was from a middle-class Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think her beauty, it does lie in her kind of how feral she looks as well. I do think she's a perfect example of that kind of sort of early years of cinema. I do think that the same when it comes to the 20s and the Egyptomania.
Yeah.
The West fetishized the East and the Middle East without really allowing a space for these actresses that were there.
I mean, you could still argue that's to date with people going,
yeah, oh gosh,
Snow
yeah.
White, because Snow White's played by a Latina woman. You're like, well, Snow White's made up.
Yeah,
it's exactly
she's
like
not there.
Snow White. You're like, I don't give a shit if the film's good or bad, I'm not going to watch it. But I do find that a little bit testing. I think, well, she also looks exactly like Snow White. You could argue as well, Mata Hari, of course, famously,
yes,
she's another one who could be argued as kind of fetishizing or adopting. I mean, she was a spy as well, wasn't she? So she is fascinating. But that's just, when I think of theater, that's somebody else that comes to mind as kind of,
yeah,
taking on that culture, as it were. The other thing I thought that's so fascinating, and it's kind of a bit before theater in a way, but still her era a bit, but is that sort of gentleman's relish of, you know, those postcards they would do of women in the Victorian, usually later Victorian, early Edwardian era, excuse me, and it was very much taking on that Theda Bara kind of, so they would dress up as like biblical characters like Salome, you know, Judith, like Bathsheba, all these things, and they would be posing for nude basically, or semi-nude and things like this. And the whole idea was taking on exotic, in inverted commas again, characters or biblical characters that were, you know, not kind of typically sort of girls from Wapping or wherever a lot of these.
Yeah.
From. And they would pose in these outfits and things and kind of that Egyptian mania type thing. It's fascinating. And so like the girls of the 20s, you know, on the screen, things like this, they're taking on that same thing of actually these gentlemen relish postcards of them posing on chaise longues.
Yes.
Like I say, as Salome or whomever else. It's a similar thread of these men that had this sort of, or whomever was buying them, let's face it, men, these sort of fascination, fixation with these sort of exotic women who actually were, in fact, as I say, not exotic.
Yeah, they were completely invented. And I think when you look at some other actresses from the time who had different heritages, like Anna May Wong, for instance, who was denied, she had, I think it was Chinese. Yes, she's Chinese heritage. She was denied roles playing a Chinese woman because of the prejudices of film industries at the time. Similar, I think she was a contemporary of Theda Bara.
Mm.
So when you look at this fetishization of the exotic,
yeah,
it is problematic, but then that doesn't detract from her being Theda and women like Theda being absolute icons and still influencing fashion and beauty standards to this day. And I think with a particular focus with this fascination with the East, so it was in the 1920s.
Yeah.
And that was, so in 1922, Tutankhamun's tomb was found, and an unexpected kind of result of that tomb being found was that the West, sorry, was
doing
the West was absolutely gripped by a fascination with Egypt, and that bled into fashion, that bled into makeup styles, hairstyles, curl eyeliner was back, lipstick was back, and lipstick allowed women kind of that freedom to paint their faces and be a bit more daring. And as I said, it had been linked to the suffragette movement slightly earlier, but the 20s was really the lipstick revolution that gave women a bit more freedom and a bit more advocacy of their own beauty. And I think what's interesting is the final, I would argue, wave of beauty during this period is a rejection of the sexualization and the exotic fetishization of people like Theda and the Vamp. And also a rejection of the soft femininity of the Gibson girl, and that's the flapper.
Ah, oh, the flappers.
Yeah.
You know, this is going into like Howard, for anybody that doesn't know them and isn't going to Google it instantly, just describe a flapper girl for us in just a few words, just so we can kind of get that iconic image of what a flapper girl looks like.
So I think kind of your iconic flappers are Clara Bow and Louise Brooks. There was more, but they're the two that I think are the most famous and the most iconic. You've got androgyny coming into play. The Bob.
Yeah.
The Bob. Marcel Wave was slightly before, but the Bob became the archetype. Very straight cut fashion, very flat chested, if you can be, but certainly fashion that hung from the body rather than exaggerating certain feminine features, and almost boyish in the way that they looked. And that must have been incredibly liberating to have been allowed that rejection of femininity, rejection of the sexualization. And that's not to say flappers weren't sexualized as well, because as we probably learned by now in this podcast, is everyone ends up getting sexualized,
sexualized in the end.
Yeah, so flappers certainly became a little bit later in the period synonymous with drink, drugs, kind of promiscuous sex. But in those early days, it really was a rejection of the kind of, I suppose it is, it's the fetishization that came in the previous, in the vamp,
well, it's just
and the idea.
Second World War, isn't it? So,
yeah.
Second World War, post First World War, sorry. So it's kind of the, you know, the women had jobs having to then not be able to work again, you know, all these kind of things. They want to be liberated, having been able to wear more practical clothing during the war and things like this. It's all a response, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it is, it's fascinating. I think we could do a whole episode just on flappers and the influence of the flappers. But summarize, I think the Edwardian period is a period of change.
Yeah.
I think that's mirrored in societal things. You've got the kind of the kind of change post-war, post-World War One. You've got the change in women's liberations. You've got the rejection of things like the corset into, really with the vamp, nakedness. Some of the pictures of some of the notable Theda B, again being one of them, they are incredibly naked.
Oh yeah,
compared to
the Gibson girls, which was
yeah
much more softly focused. These girls have got more angular shoulders, like this, you know,
yeah,
it's a different look, isn't it?
They've got their norks out and you know, that kind of thing, and
flat
and
not, yeah.
Yeah, and you've also got this creeping in of the exotic and that kind of double standards of you know, you can have someone that's exotic in quotation marks because they wear a bit of cul eyeliner and the movie theatre has invented them.
So that's
But
yeah.
Actual women of other heritages aren't getting the representation they deserve. And then finally, you've got that boyish rejection of all of those things post-war with Clara Bow, flappers, and all of the tied into all of this is that fascination with the East and Egypt and music changing and genuinely just women's standard of life changing when they're allowed to work. And there's so much you could, you know, we've scratched the surface there, but certainly I think the Edwardian period for me is such an iconic era because it's so fluid. And I think the fluidity of kind of 60s fashion or 70s fashion is influenced so much by what women and men were doing during the Edwardian.
Oh, without a doubt, because I think each era borrows from the other. So just as like the kids, they're back. The kids are back. The kids, like, they're wearing 90s stuff. And I'm like, oh, God. So I remember that first time round, which means I'm actually old. But, you know, each generation, say, borrows from the last or borrows from one previous. And of course, like, you know, as music changes, as films, and then you go into the talkies and things like this, you know, it all changes. And going through to kind of the, again, like response to war, when fabric is more limited. So you're going into the 40s and the 50s when things, you know, that kind of slightly slimmer, you know, you've got rationing, things like this. So everybody's kind of, you know, trying to be a little bit more buttoned up. And then the 50s is going a little bit more exuberant, you know, like the war's over, they're going to be more liberated. It's more about curves, boobs, everything else. And then of course you go like 60s and it's much more about women's lib and all that kind of thing, isn't it? And liberated, and they're wearing all kind of like the classic, like the eyeliner, the mini skirts, which just rocked the boat entirely. This idea that you could wear above your knee, insane. And you've got all the kind of the classic models from the 60s as well, like Eugene Shrimpton, Brigitte Bardot, of course, and gorgeous actresses like Julie Christie, all this lot that kind of, they shared like a similar look of this kind of, you know, this sort of like big, but not Gibson big, but like kind of like slightly like sort of bohemian-y kind of hair, this eyelinered sort of like doe eyes. They're all very kind of pretty and doll-like, and the whole 60s makeup was quite doll-like, wasn't it? Kind of eye-centric, like paler lips, kind of abandoned from like really, because like those plum lips that had been like small but plum coloured lipstick from the 20s, and then it was going to kind of like Victory Red and things during the World War, they'd give them quite patriotic names. And then the 50s, obviously, like Marilyn Monroe, like the pinnacle of kind of like femininity, the soft beauty, the boobs, the red lips, everything else, the blonde hair. The 60s kind of put a slant and went to peachy pale lips like Sharon Tate. And that kind of, you know, the gorgeous, like the eyeliner, the eyes, everything was centric to the eyes. I think for me, makeup wise, I find the 60s like fascinating. I mean, I love the 20s because they had such cool little, the flappers had such cool makeup things. It made them proud, wasn't it? In a way it hadn't been before, like you say. And they'd got these little carriers to carry like lipsticks and touch up their lipsticks. All these things you could do in public in a way that would have been absolutely vetoed in previous eras, in a way, you know, it could not have been worn publicly like that. And I think in other cultures, if we talk in terms of a Western culture, but like the 60s as well, they were unashamedly made up. 50s, like it changed, the 20s changed everything forever. Like you could wear lipstick, you could do these things in a way that previously you couldn't. And I, it changed it forever like that.
Oh gosh, yeah.
Without doubt. Is there anything, did you want to kind of do like 40s? Is there anything you want to kind of add before we leap through to like the 60s and 90s? If you got like some...
I think you've kind of summed up a lot about the 40s with the idea of the red lips was massively, you know, it was massively prominent. And also things like eyeliner starts to become a bit more prominent. Interestingly, you see as the war happens... kind of, you see the growth of makeup into the 30s, but really the World War II, you do kind of get this make do and mend era where women are inventing all different ways to kind of be beautiful on a budget. So I always remember my lovely old nan. She was a 40s girl, and she was one of, I think it was four sisters, and she had a couple of brothers. And her father died kind of just before the war. He was a sailor and he drowned over in Egypt. So Egypt seems to be a theme for this episode. So she grew up with not a lot of money, and she worked through the war. And she was terrible at keeping a job because she was always getting into fights with her manager, and she was always running her mouth, basically. But my introduction really to what was beautiful, I think, came from the pictures of not just my nan, but also my grandma as well, who were both that 40s kind of hair that was Victory Rolls and that kind of thing. And my nan had a bit of a kind of shaky hand, bless her. So she would, because in the 40s, tights weren't easy and hold-ups weren't easy to get because a lot of it was being used for parachutes. So women would brown their legs, various different methods. And I did a little bit of research, but it seems the most, the best way to do it was gravy granules or some sort of browning, browning. What we now call kind of like gravy granules, but it would be browning then. And then you draw a line up the back of your leg to make it look like it was, you were wearing stockings.
The seam
and my
stockings,
nan's, my nans were always wonky, but then if she was ever pissed off with her sisters, she'd purposely draw them up wonky. And I think it's interesting because, like you said, a lot of the lipsticks had quite patriotic connotations. And really played up to the idea that there was women joining the army in huge kind of robes in various different ways and serving their country in various different ways in a way that was similar to the First World War, but slightly different. And it kind of was meant to kind of not only make them see that painting their face was a patriotic thing because they could look beautiful, but also that they were doing their bit for their country. And the idea of serving, because I think by 1943, about 90% of single women in were working in either factories, on the land, or in the armed forces. That was a significant amount of women. And there was 640,000 women that served in the three branches of the armed forces for women. And it was the idea that makeup became so tied into this patriotic effort for your country that you were painting your face to do patriotic things, but also you were serving them physically. And you get kind of references to how makeup companies are doing their bit to help with the war effort by making special colour series to help match with the women's uniforms. So for example, there's a reference in the Coventry Herald, in February 1940 that says, burnt sugar is the lipstick and nail varnish for vogue for girls in khaki. For those who look chic in navy blue, the special stop red tint is all the rage, whilst the young women of the WAAF find themselves catered for with the latest red wood colour, which is the advantage of toning admirably with Air Force blue whilst remaining inconspicuous. And it's the idea that these makeup companies are being patriotic and helping the war effort by making makeup for women in uniform. And you do see in America as well, lipstick cases with soldiers on and things really echoing the war effort and becoming almost part of the war effort in itself. And I think as well, I suppose, on the plus side, is women wearing makeup and allowing that agency, it allowed them to keep a little bit of themselves in a very unfamiliar role, a very regimented role in kind of the army. You do see as well quite a lot of references to how this makeup is, on the flip side of it, distracting the soldiers or bowling over the men, and the idea that they, the sexism, the idea that because they're painting their faces, they are distracting the men from the war effort. But it is, it's interesting also how it's mirrored slightly later when you get into the 50s in film, because quite a lot of the 40s beauty ideals are still there in the 50s, like the red lip, the darker hair, rolls, victory rolls, and various different hairstyles and eyeliner. They all play a prominence in the war period and post-war. I just love the idea of spitefully drawing wonky lines up someone's leg because, you know, we're annoyed with them.
I think that's so fabulous. And I just love this idea of, like, they're aiming it, at women kind of to work with their uniforms and things like that as well. This idea of this kind of, in ways, not liberated because they're still aiming it at how women look. So you're like, but on the other hand, it's a freedom to wear makeup in a way that we hadn't known before.
Yeah.
I love going into the era of the 50s, well, 40s, 50s, 60s, the kind of the Hollywood kind of age, and some of the beauty tips they had of, you know, from things like tape where they'd put it on the side of their heads and slightly pull it back and tie it under their hairline and things, gives you a more taut look. Now people just have a facelift at the age of 23, which seems perfectly normal. but, you know, even things like hemorrhoid cream under their eyes and things. I don't think any of this is advisable, just by the way, but that kind of era of your Lauren Bacalls and things and how the beauty standards that they set. So she was very tall, wasn't she? And very slim with high cheekbones.
Yes. And yeah.
Going into other eras, maybe where you kind of got that softer, sort of poutier look. And, you know, Marilyn Monroe's makeup artist, famously, I think she had a couple, but her sort of dear friend was Whitey, I think he was known as. But apparently she would cover her face in a layer of Vaseline and then put the makeup on to protect her skin.
Yes, yeah.
And I can't remember how many different makeups she'd use, but there's a huge command for her old makeup. So people do kind of pair it up, like looking at photographs and things like that. There's a market. There's a lot of people spend a lot of money buying her makeup, and likewise Audrey Hepburn as well. And a lot of the Hollywood stars. But I suppose with Marilyn and having been treated awfully as she was, really, she's a very intelligent woman. I think to play the characters she did, to play that kind of I don't know what the word would be, really, because you don't want to say bimbo because it's cruel, because she was you have to be clever to play the characters that she did, and she was an intelligent woman, and I think her beauty, I think that must have been quite a thing to have, to everywhere you go, to know no privacy and that sort of thing. And we're not going into their lives, I know, but I think that iconic look that has lasted till today, if somebody went as somebody, dressed up as Marilyn Monroe, you'd know instantly who they'd gone, or certain shade of lipstick or hair or whatever will instantly be tied to her. And there are women, I would argue, as beautiful of the same era, but maybe of different fame and different stars of beauty and things like that. But there's something about the command of Marilyn's beauty, much like Kate Moss, I would say, from the 90s onwards. Kate Moss, 50 something now, is still the pinnacle of beauty. Like, she just absolutely, in a way, like Julia Roberts as well. They kind of, you have these women that are timelessly gorgeous that just kind of almost remain ageless as well. Marilyn Monroe died very young, which is tragic, and deeply, deeply tragic. But I think she has been immortalized. Quite whether she'd want that, I don't know, because she'd known no privacy in life, and now in death, still, everyone still obsesses. But it's interesting to look at the dynamic of what people find beautiful. Kate Moss, who famously is quite short for a model, but still about 5'7", she's tall enough. And I say that, a diminutive woman of 5'3". But I know that, certainly when, and I'm a little bit older than you, but growing up, it was all about no boobs, no waist.
Yeah.
And I did not have that figure. I mean, I didn't have particularly big boobs, but I always had a waist and a bum and things, I'm one of those who started puberty about 8. So
same. I was definitely the opposite, and I still am.
Yes,
definitely the opposite of
of what people think. And even like with all my running, like, I think I've always had like a shape, and it did come a bit with Kim Kardashian and things like that. But they kind of almost fetishized it to the point you think, oh God, I don't like having a big bum now. Because you think, oh. But it's fascinating, and this idea of how people will change their bodies and the beauty standards. I mean, they were brutal in the 2000s.
Oh gosh, yeah.
They'd put in the media and things to say, comparing, somebody to Paris Hilton, who's about 5'10" and very, very slim. And all these women that obviously had to do whatever to their bodies to look a certain way. And then you've got people like Christy Turlington, of course, who is probably one of the most beautiful women ever to draw breath, and is aging beautifully. But I think what they do that I think is so wrong is that they look at people like Brooke Shields and go, you never recognize them now. You're like, I think I would.
Yeah.
They're the same. They're just older. But like, of course, and I think we touched on that with John Calley, didn't we? Saying, this media idea of you wouldn't recognize him now. What a crock of shit. I hate that.
Yeah.
And you're like, I think we would. Liam Neeson's, what is he, 70 now or something? Still aging like a fine wine. Definitely like full DILF mode. Just saying it. I think most of us would. These women, they're like, I don't recognise it, but bollocks.
You do.
And I know Brigitte Bardot has made some very controversial comments, but in terms of like her love of animals, and she still looks like Brigitte Bardot. Like, she's in her 80s, and you're like, what did you expect?
Yeah, I think.
Sorry, yeah, you go.
No, I was just going to say, I think it's such a privilege to be able to age.
Yeah,
and
I agree.
I think we grew up in a very toxic time where not only was the insane body standards for women that profoundly affect, I think, even women who aren't voluptuous, aren't curvy, carry the weight of the early 2000s body standards. But then also, if you're a bigger woman or you're a more kind of shapely woman like myself, it was incredibly hard thing to shake off. And I think also on the flip side of that as well is the obsession even to this day with agelessness. And I know that's always been there. There's always been an idea of, trying to stay youthful or trying to look youthful. But one of the, I think maybe I'm naive, but one of the most beautiful ways to stay youthful is to keep a youthful heart. And I think that is such an obsession with this anti-aging creams and anti-aging procedures and all that kind of thing when we're privileged to age. And I think it's a privilege to see others age too, because like Marilyn Monroe being an example, so many people were taken before they should have been.
Yeah.
So I think that's certainly kind of a beauty standard ick from the modern period that I wish could go into the bin. I think we are starting to hopefully lose a lot of, maybe just the women of our generation are healing a little bit from the early 2000s. But I think it's certainly an easier space to be in a bigger body now. Not, it's not easy as in like, you know, it's, you know, effortless, but I think it's easier than the pressures of growing up in the early 2000s. But I certainly think we need to get rid of this idea that you need to have cosmetic procedures. Obviously, I'd never say to anyone they shouldn't, because we have free will and you can do what you want. But how much of wanting to get Botox at 23 or 24, wanting to do this, that and the other, is from this obsession with agelessness and, oh, you'd never recognize them now and that kind of thing.
Oh, it's always there, filters. So even, and I think I've got this right, Instagram, you know, so I put some stuff on Instagram, I think, like, you know, for our social, things like that. But I'm always surprised by the amount of times that a video will instantly have a filter on and things like this. So you're already saying what we are, you know, like, there's little things like that are constantly being delivered to us. And to us, it was kind of, you know, Topshop in its day with, like,
yeah,
you know, the jeans that you couldn't get into if you had a bum, and then you'd feel shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, all these complicated things, you know, and if you had somebody on screen who was gorgeous and bigger, like Dawn French, but, you know, like as she was in The Vicar of Dibley, most of it was known that it was her character that was appealing. You're like, yeah, but she's gorgeous. Like, she had beautiful hair, gorgeous face. You know, she was just, I just thought she was gorgeous, she was womanly, everything. But they were kind of making out that, like, it was her character that was winning people over. I was like, I just think she's a sexy woman. Like, I mean, like, I think in her own right, she just looked great. So I always find it fascinating. And in the way that they do it to women, if you choose to have children, if you don't, post kind of pregnancy bodies, things like this, you know, this constant invasion of whether a woman has, you know, is too thin, is overweight, is whatever it may be. And you think, I think ultimately, like you say, beauty is a subjective thing, but also is to the individual. And I hate it when it's categorized things like men like this type of woman, men like that type of woman.
Yeah,
Is that like a vibe?
It's nonsense.
Yeah, it's so much more convoluted, isn't it? And I think it's...
And all,
sorry, no, you go.
All that's going to do, men like this type of woman, is make me look at that list and be the opposite.
Yeah, I agree.
Because, you know, and I think all of that pressure we felt when we were younger...
and it was intense. Probably, I have to add that. Like,
you know,
a lot, yeah.
Pictures of like Britney Spears or people like that with absolutely nothing on their stomachs going, she's got fat, she's got, and things like that. And it's like
Beyonce's thighs and things. I thought, Beyonce's the pinnacle of beauty. And we,
she's a beautiful woman.
And they said we were saying last week, didn't we, this idea of like the colouring that everyone was describing as beautiful, which was very much like Britney Spears kind of, I mean, but they just ruined her life, didn't they? But kind of, she was gorgeous and her, you know, and they were like, you know, she was tanned, this blonde hair, super, super slim, all this sort of stuff. And she was kind of the pinnacle of like noughties beauty standards, and they tore her apart.
Yeah.
They tore her apart until like somebody's kind of the gutter press, someone's living moments are just harassed. Even like you looking at Princess Diana, all the charity work was always eclipsed by how gorgeous she was, or if she wore this costume. I mean, even now you look at someone like Keira Knightley, super, super talented, they'll ask her questions about her home life, what designer she's wearing. You're like, are you fucking off?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not going to go into that thing that I go into every week, because you know, a lot of the time it's not like individual men's fault, you know, it's a whole cultural thing that's shifting. And I think people are getting a lot better, but just I just think this idea of what we were shown, how we should look, you know, how certainly in the 2000s everybody had to be tall. Now I know you're tall as well. I'm definitely not tall, but they're all tall, they're all blonde, things like that. And I was short, dark hair, started puberty at like 8. And I was not fitting like the conventional standards, being like, you know, kind of like a darker colouring, like a bit curvier, all this kind of stuff. Growing up, and I know people had it a lot worse, but everybody was, you know, wanted to be tall, thin, blonde like Kate Moss, and I definitely didn't have that figure. As much shape, completely different colouring, everything. And I was like, God, this is, you know, and I think it is changing, but still there's, you know, the beauty standards that people have, and the Kardashians are clearly palpably so afraid of becoming no longer relevant, you know, that they're doing strange things to themselves. And I think actually the lesson in that is just that things just don't change. You know, actresses like Julie Christie, who's still gorgeous, but they almost vanish into obscurity after a certain point. And then you see them and say, oh, they're still gorgeous, but like they kind of just disappear from the limelight. And I know,
yeah,
like they talk about Helen Mirren, but I find that, and Judi Dench still looking great, but I'm like, but I find that patronising, because why wouldn't they? Do you know what I mean? You know,
yeah,
look,
yeah.
Helen Mirren, she's rocking her white hair, isn't that? And Andy McDowell, as though it's brave. And you're like, how the fuck is that brave? She's just got grey hair. Like, that's fucking...
Yeah, just let her be. let her exist.
Fucking brave. I think she's just living her life, because they talk about the fact that Brooke Shields hasn't had work done. Isn't she brave? Because she was so gorgeous. She's like, first of all, she's still gorgeous. Secondly, like, why should that be? Same as Julia Roberts. Why is that like an act of bravery? And usually these women are sort of starting to age that I think are still beautiful, that had been so famously beautiful, and just the roles they have to start playing and things like that, you know, and they take a bit more of a backseat because they're no longer in the conventions of kind of everything being, you know, exactly as people want it to be, and that youthful beauty. It's lunacy that sadly I think is unlikely to change.
Yeah, our bodies are battlegrounds, and I think I said that in the medieval period. Not when I was in the medieval period. I've never been there.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd fit in very well. I don't look like a spoon. But I think it's always, and there are probably times where, you know, conventions change and it's a little bit better. And I think we definitely saw a renaissance of it. Like I remember seeing the first time I saw a model with a similar body shape to me, and that feeling of just being seen and being accepted and the potential that I could be something else other than a rejection of, you know, oh, I'm not this, I'm not that. Well, actually, I could be this, I could be beautiful. And I think we do definitely have a long way to go. But I think it's been really interesting looking at these beauty standards to see the continuation of some of them, to see how at times there have been beauty standards that have been put on women by themselves to a certain extent. Mm. But more often it is that idea, like you said just before, of this is what men want. Men prefer this type of women, men like this. And that has echoed through the centuries.
The male gaze, yeah.
Yeah. And how do we dismantle that? I don't know. I don't have the answers.
We've got to, you know, educate men as well as ourselves. So if people, men, things are for the male gaze, like, how about it's for me? And of course people want to attract a mate if it's as primitive as...
Oh gosh, yeah. And that's...
That's natural, isn't it? But I think...
Yeah.
It's that same scenario when, you know, you can say, you know, somebody's... gets attacked walking through a park or something at night, and they're like, why was she there? No, teach people not to attack people.
Yeah.
Teach people that it's okay as a woman to be able to walk back to your car and not get attacked. Like, how about that crazy scenario? You know, and it's, you can't change everything, but I do think, you know, like incel, and I'm not even going to say his name, I think we know, it rhymes with Andrew Pate. He's a see you next Tuesday. But, you know, I think there's, the vast majority of men are sound, but I think just as the vast majority of women are sound, and there's, you know, in both, you know, there's good and bad, but I think it's a question of both having to be educated. I think, I mean, look at things that, you know, we're looking at, you know, corsets, beauty standards, those waists were going to 20, 22 inches, you know, 20, insane. They looked at skeletons from the 18th to the start of the 20th century, and some had not been without suffering. You know, some had been deformed rib cages, misaligned spines, things like this, you know. And I know there's still people today that are kind of into corsets and things like that, you know, and it changed with women's rights and whatever else. But, you know, I deliberately haven't gone too much into corsets because I think it is so controversial. Some people think, yes, it's, you know, they're garments of punishment. Others are like, no, they're not as bad as everyone says. Whatever it may be, they are a very tangible example of a preternatural beauty standard.
Yeah.
Boobs, preternaturally small waist, bum. You know, and there were people that they said, you know, that the flammable fabric of some of the corsets, the dresses, things like that, there's about 3,000 deaths between the 1850s and 1860s because people standing crinoline, basically, close to fires and things like that. So it's a convoluted subject, but I think beauty standards in general is a convoluted subject. And I think it's an ideal we're not going to get to where we ever say just accept everyone. Oh, I'm sneezing. I knew that was coming. And I was hoping it was... everyone could kind of be as they are. I think it's little waves of change, isn't it? And hoping.
Yeah.
I think, look, we think things are improving, and then Snow White comes out and they're like, she's Latino. And you're like, okay.
And
saying that, but fine. And that it's in the press as like a genuine problematic thing. And I think your attitude's probably more problematic, isn't it? In fact,
yeah,
it is. But you know, young girls, just as young lad, you know, the body pressure to be in shape,
oh gosh, yeah,
is huge. And because social media is so present, so
yeah,
you know, it's difficult. It you know, what's projected to us to look like Bella Hadid or whomever. But then Bella Hadid, beautiful as she is, has her own, you know, is in competition with herself and others as well. So it's cyclical for everybody. I think nobody, that's the unifying thing about beauty, is nobody is exempt.
No, we're all trapped. We're all trapped by those standards. And even if we have slightly different standards, we're all trapped by them, yeah. Because what I deem beautiful might be different to what someone else deems beautiful, but the pressures we put on ourselves based on that are the same types of pressures, you know?
Yeah. I think it's, yeah, like, I think to me, like I said, Julie Christie, she embodies me, one of the most beautiful actresses when she was young. Now she's old as well. She's elegant. Everything I find gorgeous about her, you know, she will always be Bathsheba. But as you look at her as an older woman, she's got the same grace, the same confidence, everything. And I think what a thing to be able to get old. And, you know, there's friends that I've known for years and you kind of reconnect with them and things like that. And it's such a privilege to, like, you just not always see someone for a long time, reconnect. And then that flush of nostalgia and how things, you know, change, progress. Aging is something a lot of people are robbed of. And I think the fact that we try and eradicate it and try and erase time in the way that we do seems very foolish and rather sad to me. But there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
Oh, we've been serious. I feel like we should end on a cock joke or something. I know, we're like beauty standards, but anyway, make a joke about someone's tits in the bath. But I've really enjoyed this this double episode that we've done, episodes. So I hope you guys have as well. Have you got any parting thoughts for us, young Amy?
I like being young, Amy.
Oh, well, you're younger than
take
me, only just, listeners, only just. That's the key thing.
Yes, it's only a few years. And to be honest.
It's 12 years. It's not 12 years. Yeah.
It's not. What?
Because you went only a few years, and I was like, "All right, don't make."
No, to be honest, I think you on your average day, and me on my average just teaching day, I'd look like I was your mother. Because you are youthful, because you are 183.
I'm aging like Stilton. I'm not going off, which I'm pleased with. But I've shown you after a run, and before you would be like, first and foremost, why do you not look like
at all?
Yeah, like, why don't you look horrendous? And I'm like, oh no, trust me. Like, there are days I can come back from a run sometimes and look nice. Then other times I'm trying to like go out or go to work to look nice. I'm like, why are you not playing ball? So there's no consistency.
I one of my favorite, I've recently stopped wearing makeup just because work, I don't see the point. I'm teaching children. Do they really need to see me with eyeliner on and makeup? So since I've been a teacher, I've not really worn makeup to work other than my eyebrows, because I have to try and create the illusion of big brushy eyebrows because I'm from Shropshire.
Yeah.
And a student asked me once when I first started teaching, because I have almost permanent bags because of my long COVID. Miss, why do you wear eyeshadow underneath your eyes and above your eyes?
You're like, listen.
And I think that's a beauty standard in itself, is even those beauty pressures are within a school. But no, I don't really have anything else to add. I think we've really summed up how we all have people we look up to in beauty. We all have styles we kind of are more gravitated to, or aspirations with the way we look.
Yeah.
But equally, on the flip side of that, that can be damaging in itself. It's like you mentioned Marilyn Monroe, but it's like how people like Audrey Hepburn were known for their beauty and not their humanitarian work. So I think there's always a double standard with beauty, is that it's healthy to have people we look up to and admire and wish we looked like, but we shouldn't allow that to eat us up. And I think there's a lot of work still to be done and a lot of healing still to be done. But I think it's all about finding who you are and finding what makes you you, which sounds again like I'm doing a bit of a motivational speaking or something, cringe. Yeah. But I think one of the most freeing things you can do is finding who you are and not necessarily
I tell you,
going, I'm this, I'm just this. So like when I was younger, I was like, I'm a goth, so I can only look like a goth and do goth things. But then actually, I really wanted to wear 1940s dresses and dress like that.
Yeah.
And from age, it's made me realize that you can be all of those things and be who you want to be. And, you know, that's the beauty, quotation marks, of having access to so many different styles of beauty and things like that. So certainly, I think it's been interesting to look at the commonalities between these eras and the commonalities and the stresses. But I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I have. I think it's fascinating. I think you've made a really good point there. I think the danger of fixating on people's beauty, you know, Rita Hayworth, Ava Gardner, all these very beautiful people, is that they would have had their own insecurities. Look, you know, they would have been told numerous things they had to do, like to lose weight, to do whatever on film sets and all these things. Nobody's exempt from it, no matter how beautiful, in, as I say, exclamation marks. Sorry, not exclamation marks.
I think I might have said that as well, but I meant quotation.
Quotation marks, because I was shouting that. But, you know, like they would say, they said in Notting Hill, and is credited to Rita Hayworth, they go to bed with Gilda and wake up with me. This idea that you can look at somebody and think they're beautiful, and you create a persona for them based on the fact that you fancy them. And that's, a lot of people have been burned that way, where they kind of, you know, somebody finds them really attractive and they're like, oh, they're going to be like this, because I, you know, you fetishize what they are because you find them attractive. You get to know them, and invariably nobody can ever be on the pedestal of that. Everybody's human, everybody has pores and eyebrows and issues and things they need to do, and, you know, a spot that's traumatizing them and everything else. So that's the key thing, I think, as long as you're, you know, good to yourself and good to others and drink plenty of water, you know, things will come your way and come right, hopefully. But yeah. a lot of work to do, and just ignore the press, because they can go fuck themselves, frankly.
Yeah.
Getting a title.
Yeah,
let's see what beauty's writing that. There we go. Listeners, thank you so much for coming on this long journey with us. It's going to be quite a different episode next time, but thank you so much. We really hope you enjoyed it. You've got us to over 9,000 downloads. We love you. We continue to love you. Wow. And we're so grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, genuinely, because it's, I think I said it last episode, it's so amazing to be able to do this and have people go, actually, I want to join these two weirdos on their journey when they talk about makeup, or they talk about ghosts,
yeah,
or, you know, and I mean weirdo in the loveliest possible sense.
Yeah, that's how I do.
We own being weirdos. But it is just so amazing to have you with us.
Yeah,
and
agree.
You know, we've got so much planned coming. We're not going to share too much yet, because
secret at the moment, but yeah.
secret coven stuff, but we've got a lot in store, and it's exciting to watch the podcast and be part of the podcast continuing to grow. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're so grateful to you. So we'll see you all next time. We love you, and thanks so much. Bye bye.
Bye.
Bye.